way through history, you find the same game, and human nature being what it is, it either turns a blind eye or thinks that it's far too powerful thing to oppose. Now, I met George Soros's people in India, and they admitted that they were defeated in Malaysia, because they hadn't anticipated that anybody would have the understanding how to prevent the game happening. So, but Cecil Rhodes, remember, of course, Cecil Rhodes was the front man for N.M. Rothschild. And Rhodesia was that country, and the Rhodes scholarships are paid for by the Rothschild family even today. So
that's right.
It's the same. The show moves on, you know, the game moves on, but it's always
and the Rhodes scholarship that went to a man named Bill Clinton, who you believe is a good
They say it's Rhodes scholarships, but anyway, but Cecil Rhodes said we no longer wage war for dynastic reasons, but simply because it's good business. Now, the other point is about this whole game plan of is that Rahm Emanuel, he has a book called The Big Idea. He's written it with Bruce Reed. But the final thing in Ben-Gurion's prophecies of 1962, that he said that the Jerusalem would become the world capital. In Jerusalem, the United Nations will build a shrine of the prophets to serve the federated union of all continents. This will be the seat of the Supreme Court of mankind to settle all controversies among the federated continents, as prophesied by Isaiah. Now, in 2003, I have it here on an article from the Israeli newspaper that June 2003, that Shimon Peres called for Jerusalem to be declared the world capital, and interestingly enough, what we find, it was actually on Wednesday, July the 23rd, Jerusalem touted as world capital by Shimon Peres. There was a Russian delegation in town, and I'm informed, reliably informed, that Mikhail Gorbachev was a member of that group that were calling for or endorsing his call for Jerusalem to be declared the world capital. And now that's really the agenda of what's happening in Gaza, what's happening in the world. It is to bring about world government and surrender world sovereignty to a small group.
Let's talk about the spiritual side of the Zionist gang worldwide, and it's growing in leaps and bounds. A group called the Chabad Lubavitch, or Chabad Lubavitch, the Lubavitch.
The Lubavitch, yes.
Now, the Lubies, as I refer to them, or the Lubavitch, is expanding their, and you can find them in the Mumbai bombing where they were a setup point for the Mossad activity. But you'll see them surrounding people like Vladimir Putin. And Mr. Putin has so many photographs that you can refer to with the Lubavitch rabbis all around him, and here he is playing the foil to the West, as he's designed to do. Interesting that they don't ever move very far from the rabbis. That's the only constant you have in world leadership, is that they're all surrounded by rabbis.
Yes, well, this should tell us something that... that the Muslims and the rest of the world must wake up to the fact that what they have as a group is they have continuity and cumulative wisdom of the game that is afoot. Christians, each generation has to relearn at the beginning. It is never taught because it's either kept in ignorance or keeps itself in ignorance of what really is going on. And ignorance, unfortunately, is our great enemy.
Yes. Well, I've always seen it as an honor, David, to be a provider of these facts to the world. As dangerous and as thankless a job as it is, as it often is, in my real life. I mean, I kind of live in isolation as a result of it, and I'm vilified quite liberally everywhere for presenting these facts.
Yes.
But you know something, it is a service to mankind that I try to provide, because I know that unless we can educate the masses, the suffering will be magnified tenfold without that kind of education.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Long may you continue. But it really is also, we all have a part to play. And I I've been battling on maybe for 35 years now since I converted or reverted to Islam. But I came to, you can't understand Islam until you understand Jahiliyyah. Moses had to be brought up and educated in the house of Pharaoh to understand all the machinations, all the games that were played in order that he could destroy it. And many of us that are born in the West or born, we're Christian, Anglo, sort of Judeo-Christian, let's say, but we understand the game. So it's our duty and it's your duty to actually warn the people who haven't had the opportunity to learn. We are like Moses in the house of Pharaoh, or the house of Pharaoh. We have to learn the game, and we have to defeat it, defeat the enemy of humanity by understanding what the game is. I intend to stand in the next election because you've seen what's happening in England with the corruption. But it's unless we do something, it will not go away for shouting. We have physically to engage and do things.
Well, that's right. And I, you know, David, I believe, honestly, that if given a few more months, because there is a cascading effect of this truth coming out worldwide right now.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
When I started this battle, and your first visit to my show, it was years ago now. I remember your first visit was about 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Since that time, I've gone from having 400 or 500 people listening to me to hundreds of thousands into the millions. And the truth of the matter is that there is an audience for these facts and these truths, and it is starting to take off in ways that that if they do not stop it now, they are in big trouble. And I don't believe they can stop it. Even if I were removed from my post as a describer of the facts, I still believe it's just a matter of time before they're exposed worldwide. I don't think they're going to win this one.
No, I think the writing is very much on the wall, and I think that this is this is now being recognized. But the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam said, when Dajjal fails to bring the world under his control through his machinations and systems of false belief, the Christian nations will gather under 80 banners now to bring peace in the world. Now, ultimately, the United Nations is that body. But what we have to look forward to is from Muslims to look forward to the second coming of Isa alayhi salam, Jesus, and al-Mahdi alayhi salam, who, according to the hadith that we've studied now, al-Mahdi at the doorstep, this year may be the year that al-Mahdi will emerge. And I had that on the authority of Abu Huraira. There's a whole collection of hadith that have been hidden until quite recently. And this is from a collection called Al-Mahdi at the Doorstep. So Hijri 1429-1430 would appear to be the year, and the crash that's just happened, I think, may usher in that new age.
Well, you know, it's not going to come pain-free. And
no.
What I'd like to talk about right now is some short-term possible solutions for people to ameliorate some of their suffering. Because a healthy opposition to these people is the best defense we're all going to have.
Yeah.
And, of course, we don't need to have 100% adherence to these facts. What we need is a strong minority who is well-structured against them. So one of the things that I've been advocating on the short-term basis, simply because on a long-term basis, as James Gibbs Stuart clearly states, gold is not the solution to our economic problems.
Right.
And it certainly will not cure or cause us to have a better system. But in the short term, as your money's eroding in value and as hyperinflation begins to bite, to have precious metals in this short-term period is the right move, in my view, because during these tribulations, you may have trouble negotiating in the marketplace with the kinds of fiat currencies that are being denigrated worldwide. Am I correct in making that?
I think, as a short-term measure, as an interim measure, but then you always have to remember, when you buy gold, with what do you pay? and this is always the dichotomy of paying for something in a currency that can be manipulated. Clearly, we have to go to the system that Abraham Lincoln implemented, the greenback dollar, and the treasury. Treasuries must be the sole creators and issuers of currency. Once you do that, all the speculative money that's been created, all these bubbles, will disappear overnight. And as Keynes mentioned, and with it the euthanasia of the rentier, which must happen at some point. But as a short term, to buy into metals or something that you can store relatively easy, rather than maybe copper or iron or things like that, then it is a short-term measure.
I'm telling people that if you've got needs over the next 2 to 5 years. Where you're gonna want to come out and emerge from that 2 to 5 year period with some modicum of control in your life, you might need a resource that's going to retain value.
And
that would be for the short term, gold or silver, in my view.
I think that's right. As we've seen, periodically during history, when Churchill said we went under the gold standard, for instance, he said he thought we're anchoring ourselves to stability and certainty. But what has happened? Suddenly, the price of gold had gone up 70%. Now, this was 1928, and he was going to hang the governor of the Bank of England for treason for putting us on the gold standard. So it's a short-term, thing that if you can do it. I mean, you're in South Africa. South Africa produces a lot of gold, but it doesn't set its price. And that's set in St. Swithin's Lane every day at 10 o'clock and 3 o'clock by N.M. Rothschild. So unless you control the pricing of gold, it's still a problem. But in the absence of anything else, it's not a bad idea. But the real solution is actually to campaign for the Treasury to resume its right, all treasuries, to resume their right to be the sole creators of all currency, fiat, currencies that can be created and controlled. At the moment, you've got tens of trillions of dollars chasing just a few trillions of dollars worth of trade. So it's totally fraudulent, the whole system.
Are we not, in your view, setting ourselves up for a period of fiat currency hyperinflation, not dissimilar from Zimbabwe or the Weimar Republic? And as you stated, we've got tens of trillions of dollars chasing a couple of trillion worth of goods.
Yes.
And so there's a built-in automatic inflation on the horizon.
Yeah. Well, the creation of the Ellen, have you read any of Ellen Brown's material, an American lady who's really summed up the situation? The Weimar Republic, the hyperinflation, was done precisely to destroy the middle classes, which it did. As soon as Helmut Schacht came into power, he was sent from J.P. Morgan. He was the godfather, or Montagu Norman, the governor of the Bank of England, was the godfather of his daughter. Schacht went to Germany and solved the problem. Once the hyperinflation had destroyed the middle classes, overnight, basically, the inflation came to an immediate and abrupt stop. But that was not before Hitler climbed to back on 6 million unemployed, which is part of the agenda that we're seeing now. But it could be solved within 24 hours. It doesn't have to be what they're saying it is. The agenda is to bring about world government in Jerusalem, and that's the game.
Well, I see the agenda of Hitler back in the 30s and into the 40s as being a very dual thing. I watched him use international finance for parts of his expansion policy.
Yes.
I also saw him use Zionist Jewish money, and he allowed the Warburgs to live in Hamburg.
Abby Warburg was living in Berlin, so it's the bankers were never tried at Nuremberg, interestingly enough. They all escaped, but that is the game. Hitler, of course, there would have been no war. Austria in 1932, in Wirgel, they issued their own local currency in Wirgel, the town of Wirgel, solved the unemployment within 6 months, and all the rest of Austria had decided, 300 other cities and towns, were going to follow the Wurgel example. But they were all arrested, Untergugenberger, and all the heads of the cities were put in prison to prevent them liberating Austria, because the Central Bank of Austria, like the Central Bank of the Sudan, for instance, which I know Sudan very well, I've been there many times, I love the Sudanese people, but their head of the Central Bank in Sudan, the so-called terrorist state, is appointed by the Federal Reserve of New York. And remember, the other financiers of Hitler were George W. Bush's grandparents, Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush, along with Avro Harriman and Alan Dulles.
Alan Bank, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So,
but you also bring up Sudan, and you have to say that the Janjaweed and the rest are coming, are being supplied with their weapons through Israel.
Israel, yes, of course, but they are the harbingers of war. It is the harvesters of bankers, and as Allah says in the Quran, you know, that they're there to fan the flames of war. This is their game, and because they're Hizbul Shaitan, as the Muslims listening in, they followed it. If you go to the synagogue, there's a marvelous book by Israel Shahak, Jewish History, Jewish Religion.
It's entirely on my website.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and the lady that translated that book, I met her in London at the book fair where we launched my book last month. And she translated the book and did a second translation of it. And, of course, Israel Shahak said that in the synagogue, 9 out of 10 people worshipping were not worshipping Allah Adonai, but they were worshipping Satan, who they fear more than they fear God. So how about that for monotheism? It's just monotheism of a sort. But there is no different difficulty unless you change the format of your worship. So this is where Hizbul Shaitan are the problem, and they are ever out to pit man against man. And I'm afraid that we've got to wake up to these realities.
Well, as the last segment here, David, we're going to go into your book in more depth here. The one that you've just written, it's called The Crash of 2008.
Yes.
And I want to give you an opportunity. It says The Other Road to Serfdom is in
the
co-title.
Yeah, that is the actual title, yes.
It says How Unregulated Capital Caused the Crash of 2008. I want you to give a kind of an overview of what it is you've written in this book and what some of your postulations are as far as what we are to see and how we got there.
All right. The book was commenced by a man called Arthur Swan. Arthur Swan was a great Englishman, a gentleman. He was writing. He died in 1990. He was in his 90s. Or late 80s, and he spent most of his life studying the history of the abuse of money from Plato to NATO. And I met him and became friendly with him, and I learned that he was locked up during the period of 1939 to 1945 because he had written many letters to the Treasury and to government and to the Times objecting to being asked to go and fight Germany because the Bank of England had rearmed it and created it. So it starts off from Mr. Swan as a young man recognizing that there was a problem, and he then spent all his life, he died in 1993, and I carried on with the work. Now the book is called The Other Road to Serfdom, and it is a reply to Frederick Hayek's book, a book that he wrote in 1941 called The Road to Serfdom, which Mrs. Thatcher believed in deeply. She was a great advocate of Frederick Hayek's Road to Serfdom. But he's only pointed out that Marxist socialism was a problem rather than the bigger problem that unregulated capital is the other road to serfdom. So that's where the title comes from. And it just happened that the crash of 2008 came about was because the policies that all governments have followed is by borrowing money at interest, allowing debt to escalate, and bringing about the conditions which a crash was inevitable. And so that's where it actually begins. And everything in the book, there's a chapter entitled The Islam, Riba, and Monetary Reform, in which Mr. Swan identified the problems for Muslims is that they're following the existing order. Now, Sudan, as we mentioned, I was in Sudan on several occasions. We had a seminar in Bank Faisal in Khartoum. Everyone was there, including Hassan al-Turabi and others. And we predicted that Sudan's five-year plan would fail because it was built on a fractional reserve model, which would inevitably self-destruct. And Hassan Sati, who was then, I don't know if he still is, the manager of the bank, Shamel Bank, stood up and said what we were saying was true, that the Bank of Sudan was the Bank of England with an Islamic tarbush on its head. And it was irredeemable. What I can say is that this book encapsulates, it's a history from beginning in 2400 BC. It goes through all the issues that you mentioned, that we're talking about the Civil War and what have you. It includes Abraham Lincoln's 17-point monetary plan, and it has a huge, it encapsulates most of the stuff is not taught in any standard university. We're not allowed to teach the stuff that's in this book.
Have you already had your first printing?
We've already first printed it. We went into a second print, into a paperback, and the book has been reviewed by Lord Skidelsky. Robert Skidelsky is Keynes' official biographer. Now, this is what he said about Chapter 10, The Betrayal of Keynes, which is the title of the chapter, and he's addressing this to Mr. Swan in 1990. Dear Mr. Swan, I am deeply conscious of having not written to you about your chapter, The Betrayal of Keynes, which you sent to me almost a year ago. It was partly because the issues you discuss are so deep and so profound that it is hard to know where to start, much less where to end. And I met J.G. Galbraith in Sheffield, who had also reviewed the book, and particularly Chapter 10, and he said, I love the title chosen by Mr. Swan for his book and agree with all with its overall thesis, particularly Chapter 10, The Betrayal of Keynes, which I read with considerable interest. And he mentioned this during the opening of the political department in Sheffield. And I think it's now, I spent nearly 15 years finishing it and checking it, and I believe it is an important, probably the most important book that covers a huge range of issues, which actually allows people then to start. I mean, for instance, Das Kapital is Mr. Swan did an analysis of that, and of course Keynes, you know, sort of famous theories, and it's interesting with Keynes that Professor Bronfenbrenner points out that anything threatening to the system was leached out of Keynes's thesis. And so anything that's threatening to the existing system has been taken out, and we're only allowed to teach taxation and borrowing. We're not allowed to teach what Keynes advocated, what Lincoln advocated, was the Treasury issuing the money into circulation at zero interest and retiring it through taxation, which would solve all the problems we're currently facing.
Well, you know, David, I firmly believe that the information that we share on this program, such as the causes of the financial debacle we're living through, are not understood by the masses. It really isn't. And what we've got to do here is allow a certain group of interested parties, especially from my listening audience. I have people from, and I've mentioned this many times, over 150 countries that tune into this broadcast.
Fantastic, yes.
So what we need to do is build a consensus over globally and have it grow larger and stronger over time. I mean, but we don't have a lot of time. How much time do you believe we have in the face of some of these newest threats, such as this flu pandemic that could come out of one of these laboratories in America or Portadown or Israel, for that matter? What kind of time frame do you believe we have to get this work done?
That is the $64,000 question. But from a believer's standpoint, nothing can happen without God allows it. So normally people would cower and become absolutely, nothing can happen unless God approves it. So we have to go ahead and know that nothing will happen without its approval from on high. And so we step out in faith and have the confidence. And I believe that we have the time is on our side now, because I think they've done their worst. And a third world war would actually destroy them as well. They've obviously thought about that, because prophecies, hadith also say that there will be a third world war, but that will be come after the second coming of Isa, Jesus, and I don't think we have immediately things to worry about. What we have to do is to make sure we become better informed and we network. We actually come together and understand that that we can all get on, so long as we don't feel a threat financially. And this, of course, fear of the future becomes hatred of the stranger, and this is what we have to be aware of. I just have one quote from Professor John Hodgson, who was part of our, he's dead now, he died a few years ago, John Hodgson, from Coma in Canada. And he wrote a letter in 1987, in which it was a year in which I met him, and then this is what he published in their newsletter, COMA, the Committee of Economic and Monetary Reform. Here we go again. John Crowe, the head of the Bank of Canada, and Alan Greenspan, the new man at the Federal Reserve, have given lots of speeches and interviews lately saying if there's anything they can't stand, it's inflation. So they're going to get inflation down now to zero any day, even if it kills somebody or everybody. Yes, they've got to haul inflation down to zero with high interest rates. Now, that's never, ever worked before. The fact is we've had inflation every year but one since the Bank of Canada was invented in 1934. The facts also suggest that if our political leaders allow Greenspan and Crowe to play doctor with the economy, that the result will be a replay of 1979-83 if we're lucky, or a rerun of 1929-39 if we're not. When you get right down to it, there are at least eight things wrong with the policy of trying to stop price levels from increasing by increasing the rate of interest. And he gives these points. One, the policy is immoral. Two, the policy is illegal. Three, the policy is irrational. Fourthly, the policy has surrendered North America's leadership to the Japanese. Fifthly, the policy has made all our problems worse. Sixthly, the policy has caused the large U.S., Canadian, and British foreign trade deficits. And seventhly, the policy has increased the banking system's natural propensity to self-destruct. And eighthly, the policy has resulted in a worldwide debt crisis, where our only choices appear to be between worldwide debt repudiation, depression, and or accelerating inflation. Except for these shortcomings, high interest rates are a pretty good policy.
That's tongue-in-cheek, of course. Now, here's what I contend, David.
Yeah.
You see, even if we go back to a more rational system where treasuries print the money, that's not going to take back the ownership of these stolen assets, such as our water systems and our roadways. It's, you know, I'm going to give you an example. A Veolia company, which is a Rothschild-inspired business, runs the buses in Sweden, runs my local water company, runs the electrical grid in Australia, runs the trash pickup in Britain, Now, my point is that this guy's got a $1 trillion business sitting in just one of his assets, but he's got other assets like Alstom Company that make trains, and he owns roadway systems. The autoroute Sud de la France is owned by him. So my point to you is this, is that it doesn't matter if the money goes away. They still own all the hard assets. That has to be reversed.
Well, I think it does. We have to remember what Lord Stamp said, you know, banking was conceived in iniquity and born in sin. Bankers own the earth, but take it away from them, and with a flick of the pen, they will create enough to buy it all back again. So if you wish to remain the slaves of bankers and pay for the cost of your own slavery, permit banks to create money and issue credit. And Rothschild made it absolutely clear, Mayor Amsler, permit me to issue a nation's currency, and it's irrelevant who makes its laws. So we have to pay them out with treasury money that's not borrowed, and as Archbishop William Temple said, the poor are not poor because the rich are rich. It's just that they haven't managed to make their needs constitute a market. So the poor, the Dalits, 800 million Dalits in India, all the people living in South Africa, there is no scarcity. It's artificial. So, but the treasuries must issue the money, pay out these guys, buy back the other way is that you have to put them in prison to stop them, you know, from the kleptocracy or the kleptomania.
That's exactly right, and the, you know, the fact that Veolia controls my water and controls my septic system here in my home, and that the law gives them the right to walk onto my property whenever they feel it necessary without an invitation. These kinds of laws are becoming a global, a regular global event.
Yeah.
My point to you is this: is that we have gone very far down the road to tyranny. Undoing that road is not just a monetary problem anymore. We've got a whole host of things to unwind, don't we?
We do, once you understand the money, everything is doable. What is currently considered to be a constraint is in actual fact solvable overnight. Once the people know that the expansion of N-Nort, I have a letter here from the Treasury from Anthony Nelson in 1993 admitting that the government can and does to a small extent issue interest-free money. But there is little demand for this form of money, and that's called M-Nort. So once the people know that M-Nort can be expanded regardless of the amount that you need, as long as you've got the wealth to back it or the skills, the manpower and the need, the money should be issued as the Channel Islands do, as Lincoln used to do, quantitative easing.
As Kennedy did with the silver certificates.
Correct. 1111 series executive order reissued the silver certificates, and the war in Vietnam would not have expanded. But we have to educate people to know that there's no necessity for war just to get us out of economic necessity or economic difficulties, but we need to be in control of the money supply. That is really vital. It's vitally important.
Well, David, we've reached the end of this broadcast. It went very quickly. I thank you for sticking with me for the entire broadcast.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, David Pidcock's book can be found. We will, in fact, attempt to make it available to the South African listening public as well as the rest of the world.
Yes.
I will point the people to the right direction, David. I'm going to be in touch with you on where to best get this information so I can post it on my news section of my website so that people have the right information. So, and I will be. Are you going to be contactable tomorrow?
Yes, inshallah, I should be here if they haven't got me.
Okay.
Salam to everybody there in South Africa and whoever's listening. Salam alaikum, shalom alaikum, peace be with you all.
Well, David, I want to thank you very much for being on, and I will be speaking to you soon, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. My privilege. My pleasure. Thank you. Bye bye.
Ladies and gentlemen. Was David Pidcock or Daoud Musa Pidcock, and we were graced with his visit here tonight, and we had a great and an interesting conversation about so many subjects. I hope you have learned something from what we've done tonight. Daryl Bradford Smith, I want you to all please take care of your families. Be mindful that there are righteous people from all walks of life in this world who want the best for their families and their lives. And that until the next time, be well, and bye-bye now.
Hey, what's going on? What's causing all the ladies so excited? Didn't you hear about the luxurious Turkish range of Golden Rose beauty products?
Oh, yes, so that's what it's all about? I've also heard that we can now get them locally.
That is true. All their cosmetic and beauty products are being stocked by CII stores.
And that's not all. If you make a purchase of Golden Rose products worth 250 Rand or more, you get a free makeover from CII Health and Beauty Spa.
I am so excited. I can't wait to get my hands on the range of Golden Rose.
Take advantage of this incredible offer.
Only at CII stores at the Trade Route Mall.
Or call 011-852-0097 for more details.
Terms and conditions apply.
CII Youth Foundation presents the annual June-July 2009 annual Umrah budget package. The package includes 6 nights in Medina at Roda Suite, approximately 100 meters from the Haram. 7 nights Makkah, Al Khandaq Hotel, approximately 200 meters from the Haram. Return airfare on Interlink Airlines departing on the 28th of June 2009. An all-inclusive package at 11,100 rand per person. Limited space available. For bookings, call Mulana Muhammad Sirat on 011-494-7000 or 084-584-7733 or log on to www.ciiyouth.com. CII Youth Foundation, going on the spiritual journey.